What does the world need now? It needs discernment. And it's far more than just gaining wisdom and doing the right thing. It is the key to living the abundant life that Christ promises in a world that buries us each day in disparaging headlines and worrisome news. It's understandable that many feel at times they should just bury their head in the sand, hoping it will all just go away. But what we need, and the next generation in our homes and our classrooms need now, is the courage to move boldly and wisely into a world and offer lasting hope and restoration. Discernment is key to discovering all that is good, as you will hear from Hannah Anderson, my guest on this episode of Basecamp Live.
Mountains, we all face them as we seek to influence the next generation. Get equipped to conquer the challenges, summit the peak, and shape exceptionally thoughtful, compassionate, and flourishing human beings. We call it Ancient Future Education for Raising the Next Generation. Welcome to Basecamp Live. Now your host, Davies Owens.
Hey, Basecamp Live listeners, before we go to this interview with Hannah Anderson, wanted to just take a moment and invite you to reach out to me. Podcasting can for sure be a bit one-sided, and I'd love to hear from you. There are several ways to do that. You can drop me an email, info@basecamplive.com. You can use our brand new phone number that you can call and leave a voicemail, or you can text 833-595-2929, 833-595-2929. That number is also on the Basecamp Live website. Why would you communicate with me? Well, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear where you're listening from. We have people listening literally around the world. If you are international, I'd love to hear and learn of what you're doing and what you're doing when you're listening. This is just kind of interesting Basecamp Live trivia. Some people will say, I listen while fill in the blank, riding a bike, washing the dishes, sitting in the carpool line. Just makes for a fun story, and I can give you a shout out back. More importantly, what questions do you have? As we get closer to episode 200, we're going to dedicate several episodes just to answering your questions. So call and leave the question on the voicemail, or you can text it, whether it be on parenting. We'll bring in Keith McCurdy on education, on life and culture in general. Just love to know what's on your mind. And then secondly, I'd love to hear your story. How has classical Christian education impacted your life as a parent, as an educator? For years, we did the Climbers series. And so I would love to hear from you, hear your testimony of classical Christian education, and potentially even have you on the show as an interview. So all of that can be done by contacting me again through the email or through that phone number, 833-595-2929. Well, without further ado, let's go to this interview with Hannah Anderson. Hannah Anderson, welcome to Basecamp Live. So good to have you on the show.
Well, I am glad to be with you.
Well, it's a joy to have you here. For folks that don't know you, little of your background, winner of the 2018 Gospel Coalition Book Award for Christian Living, the author of several books. You've written Humble Roots, How Humility Grounds and Nourishes Your Soul, and then the book All That Is Good that we're going to be talking about, Recovering the Lost Art of Discernment, as well as other books and other writings. And you're coming to us live from the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. It sounds really beautiful where you are.
I am. We have just hit fall. And if there is a time to be in the Blue Ridge Mountains, it is fall. Last week, we had those crisp, clear blue skies. The trees hadn't quite started to turn, but the weather has cooled down finally because it can get pretty warm here. We are in Virginia. So when we turn that corner, late September, early October, we really come into our own.
Yeah.
And this is the time to be here.
You're in the right spot.
So we are. And I know other places in the world are beautiful. I'm sure they are. But this is the place to be in fall.
Well,
so we actually came back here about maybe 9 or 10 years ago. My husband is actually originally from this area. And he has been a pastor and he just felt a call back to this region. So for 8 or 9 of those last years, he was pastoring in a small rural church and our family was very involved there and, you know, just raising our kids and trying to love God and serve our neighbor as we all are.
Love it. Well, and finding amazing time for writing too, some fantastic books we're going to jump into and hear more about. And you're also going to be one of our keynote speakers at the SEL Fall Retreat coming up in the end of October, doing basically a whole morning of sessions on this idea of discernment that we want to talk about. So let's jump in, Hannah. I'm holding the book in my hand. You know, the title, All That's Good, Recovering the Lost Art of Discernment. Just simple question, why did you write this book? And really, what is discernment? Why, I think we need discernment, but why did you write it?
Well, you know, I think all of us feel that we're in this moment, and it's been going on for several years, but because of the digital age, we are just flooded with information. You know, it's a wonderful time for knowledge, and you can Google just about anything, but that's a totally different question than whether you know what to do with the knowledge that you find, with the information you find. So we're in an information age, but I'm not sure that we're in a wisdom age or we're in a discernment age. And I have this kind of feeling of just being very overwhelmed and confused by it all, and thinking, if I'm feeling this way, I'm sure a whole lot of other folks are too. And it occurred to me that what we needed was not more what to think or certain answers or the right position, but we really needed to learn how to think about the information that was coming at us. And so the call behind this book, and I love how, you know, some folks will hear the title, All That's Good, Recovering the Lost Art of Discernment, because a lot of times we use discernment almost negatively, like it's finding all that's wrong with something. And I just wanted to make this call that, you know, we live in this moment that can be very confusing, a lot of information coming our way, and there's got to be a kind of a plumb line for how to navigate that. And the plumb line really is pursuing goodness, pursuing God's nature and his character as we're sorting through our decisions and trying to decide what to take into our lives.
Well, and the promise of the book, which I think you definitely help us come to, it's not only discernment just in terms of deciding wisely, but it's ultimately this idea that we're going to encounter God in new and remarkable ways, which mm-hmm. is something the SEL talks a lot about. I think as Christians, we talk a lot about, which is how do we flourish as a human? I mean, it's a word that's thrown around a lot, but there's not a lot of flourishing going on. There's not a lot of encountering God in new and remarkable ways. So how do you see that? Walk us through that a little bit. I mean, discernment, like you said, it's not negative, it's positive, but it could maybe sound a little static, like we're just going to sort of choose between option A and B. That doesn't sound like a dynamic right. encounter of God. How does that work?
One of the things that had to change really quickly as I studied and began to write this book, one of the things that had to change for me was my fundamental understanding of discernment. Because as you mentioned, it's not just come to the decision and make the right decision. It's about becoming the kind of person who embodies wisdom and who can think along the mind of Christ, because we've encountered Christ, because we found him and seen him and been changed by him. And the shift that took place for me, even in the language of discernment, was realizing that we use it very differently in the broader world than we use it within the church. And when we say someone has a discerning ear or a discerning eye or a discerning palate, we mean that person not only has a set of knowledge about their particular subject, but they also have the experience and the skill to navigate it and to know what is good. Mm. And so if we bring that back into the realm of biblical wisdom or of encountering God, it really is the question of, have we been changed and shaped by the character of God to the degree that we can now move into the world with expertise and see him and know him in deeper, richer ways, the same way perhaps that the musician can hear things in the music or can engage with it in a way because they have had their senses trained. And that's actually a phrase the scripture uses, that our senses would be trained and our affections would be shaped by who God is, and ultimately we would be changed. So what this really is a call to, as you said, it's not a call just to know the right answer or to make the right choice. It is to encounter God through his character and the good gifts he has given us.
Well, and it's an interesting the thinking about the word discernment, again, to your point, it's not a word that we use or use well. And I think a lot of our listeners in classical Christian schools and as parents, educators alike, the word wisdom comes up. You go to an open house, you hear a lot about come to our school, train your children in this way. Certainly biblically, wisdom is something we should strive for, but it seems like there's a little difference there in wisdom and discernment. How do those two work together?
I think the language that we use, I actually had a friend ask me this question just last week about what is the dynamic between wisdom and discernment. And I think probably within the categories that the scripture uses, they're very similar, but we use them differently. And so what we mean by wisdom is perhaps a set of principles like axioms or truths. So we think of the wisdom literature and we think of all the things that are listed in Proverbs that we might know. But discernment means living that wisdom out, embodying that wisdom, being able to take that wisdom and not only be changed by it, but then be able to live it out in true ways in love for God and love for others. And one of the ways, the book is kind of centered on the passage in Philippians 4, 8, and 9, where the Apostle Paul calls us to think about things that are true and just and lovely and honorable and all of these things. He says, think about these things. Let your mind be shaped by these things. And what a static kind of approach to wisdom would be, I'm just going to go find good things. But that dynamic part of discernment is, I'm going to be changed by good things. I'm going to be shaped and I'm going to be affected. And when something confronts me and it's true and I am being untruthful, it's going to change me and it's going to challenge me. And then I'm going to be able to walk more fully in the wisdom of Christ, living that out in embodied discernment.
And what I hear you say, and I think sometimes in our, again, in our classical Christian world, we kind of stop on wisdom, if we can say it that way, meaning know what to do right or wrong. So, you know, having grown up we were talking about the South before, growing up in the Southern world of the Southern church, Baptist influences. I love Baptists. It's all good. But what I'm about to say is there's that old saying, you know, don't drink, don't smoke, don't chew, and don't go with the girls who do. That feels like just sort of static wisdom. It's like, okay, I'm not supposed to do these things. I'm supposed to do those things. All that may be true. I don't know about that saying, but the point is, what I'm hearing in your book is that discernment stretches beyond just the do's and the don'ts and the wise and the unwise into this idea of really, you say at one point, discernment actually frees you to navigate the world with confidence and joy by recognizing how you choose to recognize the good thing. So this isn't just getting back to neutral from negative. It's like thriving or striving and moving into flourishing and abundant living.
It absolutely is. And I think that's the way the scripture actually speaks and thinks about wisdom. We don't, but I think even about Proverbs, how wisdom is embodied as Lady Wisdom. It's not this kind of repository of ideas. It is presented as this vibrant, dynamic person. And you get to the end of Proverbs in Proverbs 31, and you see this woman, the Lady Wisdom, living out in full flourishing the truths of the rest of the book. And so it is very much a call into a life of goodness and a way of being. It's not just about staying away from all the things that could disrupt your life or scuttle your life. It is about this forward dynamic and progress and movement toward the goodness of God himself.
Well, and again, we're going to get into some very practical applications of this. And I think just what I love about the book, I mean, you literally began with the opening, quoting Genesis 1:31, God saw all that he had made and it was good. But then you said, wonder if God would still have said this had he read the morning headlines. And I think that's what we feel is this sense of, well, that wisdom, discernment stuff is all good and great. But right now, have you seen what's going on in the world? Like, you can't be running around confident and joyful. This is a horrible place. In fact, maybe we should just hunker down and retreat and stay away from it all. And again, what I love about what you're saying is, no, this is a call to joy and a call to engage, which is the opposite of hunkering down, which seems like a natural response potentially. So
Yeah, it's a very anxious age. And I think a lot of that anxiety has been linked to the way we encounter information and with our social media feeds. And so I do think the prevalent emotion right now is anxiety and fear. And I think a lot of that has to do with we feel ill-equipped. We don't feel like we have a sense of what's going on. And so one response is just to try to control everything. But that becomes very rigid and it's not moving into abundance. It's just kind of trying to stop the panic, stop the anxiety.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the life that Christ is calling us into.
No. And I think, again, we should take a break here in just a second and come back because I want to, you know, this abundant life, which Christ offers, is available to us. We make choices every day, starting probably with which headlines we go and read as to how we're going to interpret the day and how we're going to discern our way through the day. So again, it's that tension. We got to be in the world, but not of the world. So how do we do that we don't miss out on all that God has for us? So why don't we take a quick break and come back? Because I know folks are eager to hear, because I think everybody listening, myself included, is thinking, oh my goodness, if there's any more bad news coming at us right now, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. And yet we're supposed to be these living this abundant life, which is attainable. It's not just a kind of sticky, sweet, Hallmarky Christian thing that we talk about, and then we have to live over here in depression. I think there's a way through this. So Hannah, look forward to hearing your thoughts on this. We'll be right back with Hannah Anderson. He's worked with families for more than 30 years as a licensed professional counselor and marriage family therapist. It's time for a quick encouragement on the best practices of raising the next generation. We call it a McCurdy moment. Hey, Keith, a question that I often hear is this question around how do I balance as a parent, maybe even as an educator, being the authority and being a friend of my child?
Well, the simple answer is we don't. And even thinking along those lines will get us in trouble. And so I'll give you an example. If we think of this as a parent, we have three key stages in our role with our child. The first couple of years of life, we're nurturers. We're hovering around our children. It's the one time in life we get to hover and be helicopter parents and be snowplow parents. Our job is to nurture, keep them comfortable, keep them alive, let their development begin. Then we very quickly shift into, which is one of the larger spans when they're in our own home, really the role of discipline and discipleship. And that is where we are beginning to introduce them to, in a sense, the rigors of life, ownership of life, burdens, chores, responsibilities, accountability. And a friend can't do that because a friend relationship is a 50-50 relationship. It's very much, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. Whether we like it or not, that's often what we try to do with our children. Well, the problem with that is children have free will and they rarely like to do the things we want them to do for us. And when we attempt to go about it as a friend, it distorts the relationship and distorts their ability to understand authority. And yet we're going to be sending them out in the world to deal with many other authority figures the rest of their life. So we really have to take that middle role of discipline, discipleship. And then the third role is once they are older teenagers and then off in life is mentors. And a mentor is someone that through their upbringing in life, our children have determined we have a little bit of wisdom. So there's a desire to continue to have contact with us because we've walked the path before them.
Right.
And there's some wisdom in that. And in that framing, that is the place where friendships often develop, where we, with our young adult and adult children, enjoy life in new ways with them because we have gotten through those other areas well. So when parents come in with young children in their home, they're wondering about how can I be a friend and authority? My first response is you can't, or you can attempt to and it will fail. And then we walk through the placement of these roles.
Yeah, and I would think educators would have it's different, but similar in the sense that yes, you need to be the authority. You don't need to be another kid in the classroom and too friendly at the same time. You know, there's the two ditches you can fall into. There's plenty of, we all remember teachers that were just sour, dour, whip cracking up at the lectern and acted like they hated every moment of being in the classroom. They weren't very friendly. So how do you balance that in the educational world?
Yeah, I run into teachers a lot that have that struggle. And often it's younger teachers that have that struggle because there is this internal desire that we really want to make a good impact. And we want to be liked. I mean, who doesn't want to be liked? And that's a great thing. But when our focus becomes being liked in the classroom, then we're really operating kind of on that friendship model. And we need to stray away from that. The better model is truth and kindness. As a teacher, we need to be truthful to our students, truthful about our expectations, about how we're going to hold them accountable, and do it in a kind way. So we are establishing a pattern to where we can be liked, but that's not our goal.
That's great.
Our goal is to be kind and demonstrate kindness in our interactions, but we still have to maintain authority. You know, I've heard this term many times, but used by many people, and it's true for parents and for teachers. In some ways, what we want to operate is a benevolent dictatorship. We are in charge, but we're lovingly in charge.
Yeah, that's great. That's I think, what we all want. I mean, if we think of ourselves as children, what kind of a parent would we want to be interacting with? Or as a student, what kind of teacher? So great wisdom, Keith. Thanks as always. Got a question for Keith to answer on a future McCurdy Moment? Well, send it to us at info@basecamplive.com and learn more about Keith McCurdy on the speaking page on the Basecamp Live website. Well, welcome back here with Hannah Anderson, talking about discerning our way through the world that is often rather bleak and dark. And this is not just a call to sort of happy veneer Christianity or veneer living. This is deep stuff. It's enduring. It's lasting. But Hannah, how do we do that? Because the world sure seems like it's weighing in heavy on us, and yet we're called to live this abundant life as people who have discernment. So help us with this.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned that this isn't, you know, a fake or veneer, because that is the other temptation, right? So one way you can engage with the world that we live in right now is the flood of information. It's overwhelming. You can't process it. You pull back, you know, you kind of hide away, or you just try to control things. But the other thing that I see happening a lot online is this false front or this false presentation, where we think, well, I want to be joyful. I want to be happy. I want to have all that's good in my life. And we do a lot of presenting. It's kind of a hashtag bless phenomenon, right? And yeah. it doesn't really speak to the real world. And you don't realize it until you just get a little bit under the surface. And I remember particularly this happened with me once, and this happened before I was writing the book, that I like to make pie. I'm a pie maker. Grew up making pie. My grandmother taught me how to make pie. And so I do that for relaxation. That may sound, folks may not find it relaxing.
I'm getting hungry hearing you talk about this. What's your favorite pie to make? Do you have a preference there in your pie making world?
Black raspberry pie.
Now I'm definitely
black
hungry.
Black raspberry pie.
All right. Yeah. Carry on. Yes. So, okay.
But I always like to look for new techniques. And, you know, if you've been on the internet at all, social media, Instagram, there's always these kind of cooking techniques or these videos that come through. And I found one day that was the perfect, how to make the perfect pie crust, how to make it beautiful, and three easy steps, right? Do this, do this, do this. And then at the end, you'll have this brilliant, beautiful pie. Except when you actually try to do it, it doesn't take 2 or 3 minutes like the video shows. It takes hours. And inevitably, that you can't do what the video is presenting, because there was a lot of skill and time and effort put into that video, and a lot of editing and a lot of cutting. And so there's this gap between this good life that is being presented to us, that is being offered to us, and our actual ability to live into that abundance. And that kind of tension between, we can't be caught by the brokenness, but we also have to be realistic that we do need wisdom to navigate this world, because it's not as bright and shiny and beautiful as is being presented to us either. And that taught me, even just that small experience, that there's this gap. And what's going to fill that gap? And really, I think for Christians, that journey from where we are to where we hope to be is a journey of sanctification. And that in other words, it's a journey toward holiness, but it's a journey toward goodness. It's a journey toward God himself through the world that he has created, by engaging with it, by learning from his good gifts, and learning to rightly relate our hearts and affections to the things that he loves as well.
So it sounds like a lot of times we're I guess there's a counterfeit, there are counterfeit gospels. There's a counterfeit promise that is often made in our YouTube culture around the abundant life or living joyfully in Christ. And I mean, you know, it's a typical Sunday morning where, you know, the kids are squabbling and the adults are, you know, husbands and wives are arguing. And then you walk, get the minute the minivan door opens, everybody puts on a smile and it's happy church time. And it's like how that after a while is wearisome, because you just feel like this is not a gospel for the world in which I'm really living. I need a gospel that works for me while I'm driving down the road in the minivan, going to church when things are falling apart. And the case you're making is that there is a we can rediscover this beauty and goodness that God has established from the beginning in the real world where things are still broken. It's not a veneer. It's not a turnoff, which I think is so often where people walk away from the church or walk away from a vibrant faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we see this embodied in the gospel itself, right? It's the crucifixion and the resurrection. It is the brokenness and the pain and the suffering that is true and real, but it is also the hope of recreation and goodness and life, ultimately overcoming death. And so even within our Christian walk, we're living in that kind of reality that, yes, this is a world of suffering and brokenness and evil, but ultimately goodness is the plumb line. Evil isn't. Ultimately, the resurrection teaches us that God and life and truth overcome the evil. And so in that sense, it's a disposition that we have within the world. It's not a denial of the brokenness, and it's not this Pollyanna vision, but it is this deep-seated confidence that the goodness of God will prevail. And ultimately, how I define discernment in the book is knowing the difference between good and evil, so that you can pursue good. It's not just knowing the difference between good and evil. It's a movement toward goodness and God himself.
So I want to kind of shift this into even, I mean, you've got so many wonderful stories in the book and it gets very practical. And you'd said earlier that we live in an age where we mistake information for knowledge, and that the deeper knowledge is the road to freedom. And a lot of what you've talked about is really this connection between the virtues and discernment. So knowing well what God desires, Philippians 4:8, I know is an anchor point for the book, whatever is true, honorable, just, pure, lovely, commendable, you know, think on these things. What does that look like? Kind of walk us now into this daily life of wake up in the morning. How does this engage our world? I mean, what does that look like in a way that really is transformative?
Right. Well, I do think that we have to define truth, justice, and all of these virtues by God first. And I want to put that forward because we do live in a time where everyone has their own truth, right? So everyone has their own kind of sense of what is true. And I think what that requires of us is, at base level, knowing God and knowing his word. But then living that out means taking and testing. A lot of times the scripture, when it talks about discernment, it talks about the idea of weighing or testing things. And we live in a moment that doesn't want to give you time for that. Everything is react now, quick, share this, like this, tell me what you think. And what the scripture is actually calling us to is a pause and space to think and to weigh and to test. And so I think if there's one thing that just practically starting this process, I think what we all need is just to stop, you know, stop our reactions, stop our gut instincts, and really understand that this is a much more engaged process than just being carried along by current movements or forces around us. But more than that, it's also allowing the truth and justice to confront us. And I find this even when I'm online. It's one thing for me to pursue truth in other people's Facebook posts. It's one thing for me to advocate for the facts in a comment section. But am I submitting myself and my own statements and my own opinions to that same standard? And I think knowing that discernment judges us as much as it judges the world is the piece where virtue and sanctification comes into play, where we are being changed. Because if we are truly pursuing what's true, as Paul says in Philippians 4, the untruthfulness within our own hearts will be revealed as well.
Well, and you make a really interesting point in the book around this idea of we are an age without any anchor points, where truth has become so hyper-individualized that it leaves us wanting. I mean, if the highest anchor point in the world is ourselves, it leaves a lot to be desired. You tie a very interesting point back to the fact that so many people love murder mysteries. I thought this was fascinating, and that you, I know, are a fan of Nancy Drew and Agatha Christie and Father Brown. Connect that up, because I think that's really interesting. Why humans, even good godly people, like murder mysteries? Like, what is that doing for us in this pursuit of truth?
This was one of my favorite chapters to write. It's the chapter that it's exploring truth, and it kind of uses the fact that murder mysteries became most popular at the beginning of the 20th century in the wake of World War One. After World War One and that season, 1920s, 1930s, the world was experiencing this profound. All our hopes and dreams had been dashed by World War One, and there was just this gutting of all we thought we could trust as societies. And so the murder mystery gained popularity in part because people were looking for clear right and wrong. Hmm. They were looking for justice to be served. They wanted the mystery to be resolved and that the perpetrator would be caught. And there was a sense of righting the world and regulating the world in that space. And I think that's also why you see people like Dorothy Sayers, who advocated for a Christian worldview and was an apologist, was also writing murder mysteries. She was able to engage in both genres because at root, they were both a search for what is true. And I love I never understood why I love murder mysteries so much. I mean, it seems like it's not a topic that a good Christian person would enjoy.
But so many do. And now we know why. This is really an interesting connection. Yeah.
And within the culture of the murder mystery writing community, because this was a new genre that was emerging, especially in the UK, there was a set of writers who would get together and they would kind of hold each other accountable for what a good murder mystery should be like. And some of the basic rules of writing a good murder mystery was that you had to be truthful. Like, you couldn't just out of nowhere pull a solution. That you couldn't just suddenly give the reader this perpetrator that didn't make any sense. And so you had to follow within a certain set of structures that the reader could themselves follow. And it just gave that level of certainty and structured accountability, I think, that so many of us long for. And even within this moment, in this current contemporary moment, I think people do long for truth and accountability. I mean, we all say we want to live our own lives, but deeply we are crying out for wrong to be righted, for truth to be made known. And you see that even on social media. A lot of the tension we see around issues is this deep cry for truth to be established.
Well, that makes perfect. And a lot of people, again, anchoring to a particular set of truths and saying this has to be the way it is because there has to be an absolute. That I just think that's it's a profound discovery, or to me it's a discovery of just not only the link of the murder mystery, but just we know that there's such this deep human longing for truth, for a connection. I mean, we are really children that need this Abba Father that we can sit in the divine lap and just have a sense of the world is going to be okay, and there are things that are wrong and there are things that are right, and justice will be done. I mean, again, back to just the basic idea of discernment, if we can calibrate ourselves to see the world the way God sees the world, it is a freeing, it's freeing to us. Otherwise, we're kind of spiritual tumbleweeds, I guess, out there. That's to use a word I just made up. So, but that's a really encouraging point. Well, let's take another quick break, Hannah. I want to come back again. You've got these great stories, and just help us walk through this process of kind of moving from our hunker down bunkers, trying to either stay away from the world or all of the contention to how do we move into that, just that joy that God so offers us as we discern wisely. So we'll be right back with Hannah Anderson. Well, Hannah Anderson, we're so encouraged just to be reminded again that there is goodness. I know that sounds so basic, but it's sometimes, we feel like we're getting these fiery darts shot at us all day long, and to be reminded that God has such a better desire for us and the way we live out our days. And certainly as parents, as educators, we've got young people looking at us and we try to put true, good, and beautiful things in front of them. And there's a deeper reason to do that than we're just supposed to. So, but let's get practical. This is a mom, as a leader in your church community. How does this play out again in just day-to-day life? You wake up in the morning. How do we help guide young people towards discernment?
You know, I have to be honest about writing this book. I told you how I kind of moved toward the conversation to begin with, but something really unusual happened. And I want to kind of share this as I answer your question. Sometimes we write to answer our own questions. We puzzle things out to figure them out for ourselves. And sometimes you can get to the end of a project and say, oh, that's what I was doing. I didn't realize that was the conversation I was having. So as I was finishing up All That's Good, one of the things that, publishers want you to do is to make a dedication. And I knew that I wanted to dedicate it to my children. So my children, Phoebe, Harry, and Peter. So I dedicated it to them. And then I was like, oh, that wasn't just a dedication. This was my heart for them. And I didn't realize what had happened, but I used a lot of family stories, our experience as parents. And then as I was thinking about Proverbs, the book of Proverbs, this book about wisdom and embodied discernment, and it opens with the exact same approach. My son, give ear to my words. And I realized that even though I wrote All That's Good for all of us to have this conversation about discernment, what I was really doing was trying to help my children who are now 17, 15, and 12 know how to navigate the world that they soon would be entering without me. And it was just one of those moments of, oh, it wasn't sitting down and saying, here's your list of right and wrong. What, when it came down to it, what I wanted to give them was a way of being in the world. It was loving the right things. It was, I guess you could say, principles, but what I wanted them to know about God's world and about God himself was that there was a way to navigate this world toward God and toward goodness. And then I started thinking, oh, well, that's Deuteronomy 6. You know, when you sit down and you rise up, you're talking about the things of God. You're not just handing off lists, or you're living this out in front of them and with them. And so I started thinking, there's a lot of practical ways that happens, that aren't just lists and check marks, or don't go here, don't drink, don't smoke, don't chew, don't go with the girls that do.
Yeah, you've heard that one too, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or the boys, I guess. Yeah. Too. All right. Okay, so what does that look like? Walk us through just if we were kind of following you and your kids around for the day, yeah. Where are these moments where you glean these opportunities to train in discernment?
Well, my kids would tell you that they would much rather be disciplined by dad than mom. Not because mom is harsher, but because mom will sit down and have a 45-minute conversation with you about what you did wrong and why you did it, and exposing all of the areas of blah, 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 blah. So they would much rather get it over with. But one of the things that we have learned as parents is that children do need to understand themselves and why and how they're moving through the world. But they also need to go through the process of making decisions and watching you make decisions. And I think one of the temptations as parents is when we're making choices or whatever, we may want to go sequester ourselves and wrestle through the question and then come back and tell them the answer. And one of the things my husband Nathan and I have just chosen to do is to wrestle with a question in front of them. And as age appropriate to bring them into the process. So for example, just a real practical question that you need discernment on, can I go to with this friend somewhere, or can this person, you know, can I be with this family or do this thing? And pulling them into it as we make the decision, asking them, well, what do you think? And what is the reason? And how, and bringing all of that to bear, it takes a ton of time. But ultimately, what you're doing is you're forming that child. It's not just reaching the decision. You're forming that child, and you're showing them how to weigh and test and live out the wisdom that might be more abstract.
That is a great example. And I would, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about, and that's also why we want to expose our children to the great books and the great ideas, because these are people who've lived before us that kind of had these difficult moments where they had to make wise or unwise choices, and you see the fruit of that. So it's literally being played out in front of our children in the real world in which you're living. I think that's genius. It makes total sense.
Yeah, I think there is something to be said about knowing that children are, they're people too, right? That is one of my core commitments as a parent and as even a Sunday school teacher, is that children cannot necessarily make the decisions adults make, or they don't have the maturity or the wisdom, but they have the basic skills. And at their level, we need to be entrusting them with the decisions that they can make as we guide them through the process. Otherwise, they'll get out on their own. And the box, there are no boxes to check in the world, right? It's a very messy, complicated place. And we want them to be able to think critically about it and move through it.
And I think it's hard for parents, maybe educators too, and that you, where is that line between they're too young to engage this issue, so we'll leave them out of it. And then all of a sudden they wake up on their ex birthday, and now we almost, you know, we overcorrect the other direction. And the kids are left, I think, or students are, you know, children or students are just left in this middle state of, I've never was really modeled well how to make decisions and to sort through difficulties. So I think that's a really good example. What are some other ways that you play that out?
Well, while they're making the decision, and I have teenagers, so we have a lot of these hot button issues that are coming up because, you know, they have friends who are not Christian, they're not in Christian families, and they're encountering a lot of the just issues and agendas of the world. And so they come up. And the second thing in parenting that you have to do is not freak out, not freak out, because your kids are in process. And what you want is to walk through that process with them. You're not saying, and hear me, I'm not saying it's okay wherever they end up on a question. But what I am saying is it makes a ton more sense to help them wrestle through it now with you than when they're on their own.
Yeah.
And I mean, even really difficult questions like sexuality and, you know, how the world approaches, you know, our sense of identity and all of those questions. And letting that process play out is probably one of the hardest things a parent can do. You're not taking your hands off of it.
Right.
And I want to be very clear about that. You're not abandoning your children to the process, but you're also kind of letting them move through the stages of questioning and learning and correction and process with you while you're there with them.
And can you think of, I mean, again, the hope is not only do they get through that and they made a decision, but then they can look back and from their own vantage point and see, okay, boy, that the abundant life is so much richer from going down this path than that path. And that's really the, again, key point.
It is.
It's not just, I got through this static decision, again, to the point of your whole book. There was this really way better 10x improved answer in the end. It was, there was joy in this that I would have even expected.
Right. Because ultimately, we have to remember that it's not about just avoiding certain things.
Right.
It is about moving toward goodness. And so ultimately, when I'm talking with my kids about marriage or sexuality, it is as much about the goodness and the beauty of God's design than don't do this.
One of my, I often quote Thomas Chalmers, 19th century philosopher thinker who wrote The Power of a New Affection. And it's a simple point that, you know, people are far more persuaded by something virtuous than something vice oriented. It was the old Nancy Reagan, just say no to drugs. Well, like, but you gave me nothing to say yes to. So now I'm stuck in the middle here with just feeling negative all day. So
absolutely
aiming them in a better direction. So, well, Hannah, this is really encouraging news. Any kind of final thoughts to those who are hearing this? Obviously your book is a great resource. Any other encouragement you'd like to leave folks with?
Well, I do think this is a hard time to keep our eyes focused on good. And what's interesting about the passage in Philippians 4, 8 through 9, the verses just before that, Paul is admonishing us to be anxious for nothing and to cast all of our cares, you know, to take them to God in prayer. And then he moves toward put your mind on these things. And I want to encourage folks that if you're not seeing the good right now, that's not unusual, but it is a spiritual discipline in some ways for us to actively remember the goodness of God and put our minds on those good, true, and beautiful things that he has given us.
Well, I mean, maybe just a final footnote, because you're saying that makes me think. I mean, we also live through our feelings versus our knowledge. How do you suggest that balance? Because again, a lot of times what people are saying is, I don't feel this of God, or I don't feel this moment. We don't want to toss feelings out, but we also want to be driven by them. How do we balance that?
Well, I think facts. I'm a big fan of facts.
Most people listening are. We are good classical culture people. Yes.
Yeah. So, and I don't mean head knowledge. I don't mean head knowledge when I say facts. Mm-hmm. I mean that our emotions, God bless them, they're wonderful gifts, but they signal what is going on around us or inside of us. That they don't tell us the truth about the world necessarily. And so when we are in those places of, I don't feel goodness, I'm not experiencing the goodness of God, one of the ways that we reorient ourselves is to remember the facts, remember the goodness of God, delineate the beauty and the goodness and the gifts that he has given to us. Because, you know, when you think back, and this was in the Old Testament, the children of Israel were instructed and commanded to remember what God had done for them. Yeah. And that is just a fact-finding mission. And so I think when my children were young, particular, and we would get caught in moods, I would take their hand and I would open their fingers and I would say, you have five fingers. Tell me five good things. Tell me five, for every one of your fingers, tell me a good thing that God has given you in your life. And that was just grounding us again in reality, despite the overwhelming mood and emotions.
That's really well said. I've got a book I've had for years, 10,000 Things to Praise God For. It's a fascinating little silly book, in a sense. It's just a list of things, and it's stuff that's as mundane as windshield wipers and peanut butter. But it's an interesting, to your point, it's if you just flip through that book, even on a day where maybe your emotions aren't there, and you think, well, some of these are silly, but I mean, imagine going driving in a rainstorm without a windshield wiper. I mean, it's a silly thing, but there's so many simple provisions and resources that God puts around us, mundane and spectacular, that really are sources of goodness and hope. So,
I would just add this, that the existence of goodness doesn't mean that the bad things aren't happening in your life. And we don't want to say that, you know, remember, count your many blessings, right? And then you won't think about the bad things.
Great point.
But what often happens when we are overwhelmed is we forget the good things, and we very easily remember the bad things. We don't have to have the facts about the bad things, but we do need the facts about goodness.
Really good. Well, thank you for reminding us of all that is good, Hannah. For those who want to learn more about what you're doing to follow you have a podcast too, right? Persuasion?
Yes. I co-host the podcast Persuasion with Aaron Straza, and we tackle a variety of different issues, Christian, and take a Christian lens on what's happening. And this fall, we're actually doing a new thing. We are doing a read-along. We're reading through Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Oh, wow.
So we're getting to talk through that and connect it to current state of things, and we're really enjoying that.
Wonderful. Well, I encourage people to listen. And then your website, sometimesalight.com, is that a good place for folks to?
That is where you'll find everything in one place.
Yes, hey, that sometimes sounds perfect. Okay. Well, very good. Well, Hannah, thanks so much for being on Basecamp Live. Thank you for your writing, and look forward to having you back and hearing and learning more from your future writings, which I'm sure will be happening. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey, Basecamp Live listeners, thank you again for listening to this episode and for your faithful support and encouragement for going on 4 years of podcasting. It was so good to meet many of you in person this summer at the ACCS and SCL conferences, and I always appreciate getting your emails. Reach out to me. Let me know where you're listening from, what's on your mind. You can get to me at info@basecamplive.com. This fall is going to be an exciting time for Basecamp Live with some new formats and updates coming to the show. We are also grateful for the number of individuals and organizations who partner with us. So a quick shout out to these groups who I know personally, their leaders, and the quality of the resources that they provide both to individuals and to schools. First of all, the focus group. If you're running a capital campaign or working on a major donor development project, they are accomplished, skilled, and ready to serve you. Secondly, Classical Academic Press. Chris Perrin and his team continue to build a wealth of curriculum and training materials for your classical Christian education, whether you're teaching at home or at school. Thirdly, Scola Inbound Marketing. Their proven model is helping schools attract and keep new families, a value to any school. And then fourthly, the CLT, or Classic Learning Test. Jeremy Tate and his team provide students with an alternative standardized test that is a much better way for students to demonstrate their knowledge and abilities. As we know, the SAT and ACT are being set aside by so many colleges and universities. So thank you so much for these resources and options that are given to us by these great sponsors. Finally, again, let us know where you're listening from, info@basecamplive.com. We'll connect with you again on our next episode. Thanks again for listening.